Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Doug Hoyt. Today is 2 December 2019. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Hoyt is kind enough to join me by telephone from Montpelier, Vermont. Doug, let's start this interview with a little bit of information about your early life. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Burlington, Vermont, November of 1945.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your parents. What were their names?
Father was Lloyd, and my mother was Barbara.
Mm-hmm. What did your folks do for a living there in Burlington?
You know, I'm not really sure what my father did at the time in Burlington. I'm led to believe that he worked at a Bell aircraft manufacturing facility that was located in Burlington during the World War II.
I see.
My mother, I think she was, she was a nurse.
So did you grow up in Burlington, or did the family move?
No, we were only there for a couple of years, and then we moved to East Montpelier. And at that time, my father took over a position with REA. REA is the acronym for Rural Electrification Agency. It was a federal activity for getting electricity into rural areas. And 1946-47, there were tons and tons of areas in Vermont, the rural areas, that did not even have electricity. So it was a big push to have that happen. So in fact, we even lived in a location that housed some diesel generators that provided some of that electricity. And then from that point on, he became a foreman, and they were building electrical lines to go out into the, rural area.
Mm-hmm. You say that you were born in 1945, and he was, as you believe, working for a Bell outfit up there. Is it safe to assume then that your father didn't serve in World War II, given his job?
He was, I never really got a clear understanding on that. He was the youngest male in a large family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was some sort of process going on at the time in the war that the youngest male in the family did not get a chance to go fight.
Mm-hmm.
And they were given the opportunity to go in other areas. That's what I was led to believe, but I never really went and looked to see if that was true or not.
Sure. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had a brother that was born about 5 years after me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've since learned, although I suspected when I was growing up and was a teenager, that I might have some siblings. I learned and I confirmed that I have a half-brother and a half-sister.
Hmm.
I've tried to meet them, but that didn't work out well.
Sure. Tell me about growing up in Vermont. What was that like for a kid back in the 40s, 50s, 60s?
For me anyways, it was actually kind of easy, and I don't want to say I was left to my own devices, where you could easily get into trouble, but I did not have anywhere near the restrictions that one would impose upon today's children. Are even the restrictions I impose than my own children. But, you know, if they wanted to go out and play in the hills or do that, you know, I could do that. If I wanted to go fishing, I could do that. And when old enough, if I wanted to go hunting, I'd go hunting. I didn't, you know, but you were free to do what you wanted. Yeah, I went to a parochial school, and, you know, if anything, I think I got a very good, you know, secondary education. But developing friends was relatively easy, and life was pretty stress-free as far as I could.
You mentioned school. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to a school in Montclair called St. Michael's.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 1 year, kindergarten year, in the public school. And then I don't know the reason, but I was, you know, I was sent to parochial school. I jokingly think perhaps my mother thought it would be good for me because I might be a little too stubborn and do things on my own. I needed some structure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so I went there, and then after graded school, then went to the high school, which was a very small high school, even by Vermont standards. And graduated from there. I didn't overwhelm anybody with my academics, but you know, I didn't get in trouble either.
Mm-hmm. What were your favorite subjects in school? What kind of things were you interested in?
I kind of enjoyed physics, the sciences. I actually enjoyed math, and I kind of liked English or literature, however one looks at it.
How aware were you of what was going on in the country as you were growing up? The civil rights movement, or the Cold War, or larger national, international issues?
Well, the late 50s and early 60s were concentrating on a lot of things in the national area, but they didn't seem to impact me anymore. People my age were not as aware of what was going on as, you know, similar groups of people would be aware today, or even 20, 30 years ago. The idea of conflict in Vietnam was pretty much foreign. You got to remember, I graduated from high school and 1963, so the whole idea that the thing in Vietnam was heating up just didn't register.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kids often had bigger and more important things on their radar than what's going on in the world around them, especially at that time. Well, you graduated in 63. What did you hope to do upon graduation? Were you interested in the military? Were you aware of the draft? Are you looking to go to college? What were your plans?
I think I was aware of the draft, but I was not overly concerned about it. I can't remember when I registered, but I did when I was supposed to. I was thinking that I would go to college. In fact, I applied for and was accepted at a technical university, you know, and made it in. I did what I could do to help pay for that, but life would have it. You know, my parents did not have the economic resources to do that. And, you know, the concept of scholarships and things weren't super large in, you know, 63. So, but at any rate, I went. And it was a tough school. You really had to be on your toes, and you had to knuckle down and do the work. And I could do that. I was trying my best. But at the same time, there were a lot of distractions and everything else. And, things got away from me. Their school year was a little different than what most colleges or universities would have. And it's like 22 weeks would make a half year. And by the time I got to the end of 22 weeks, I think, I say jokingly, but the school and I came to an understanding. The understanding was that I wasn't really doing what I needed to do in order to continue. They came to the conclusion that we probably wouldn't want to be able to get through the remainder of the year. So the smart thing to do is to not spend any more money, waste my time and their time, and move on. And I don't regret that necessarily. I think it was a realistic recognition of where I was at that time. College was not the best place for me at that time. College felt the same way.
Well, that's certainly not uncommon, and it does take some degree of wisdom, whether it's you or the college or both, to know when it's time to move on from each other.
Yeah.
A lot of folks don't buy into that quite as quickly. Well, what did you want to do at this point? I mean, what options were available to you?
Well, I didn't have much for options, and I started looking around for some work. Get some income.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work?
So I ended up as a manager trainee in a shoe store.
Mm.
Don't ask me how, don't ask me why. That's where I ended up. And, so I did that for a while, and then I thought I did okay with that. Somebody else must have thought the same thing, because the next thing I know is there was offered the opportunity to be a manager of a shoe store over in New Hampshire.
Hmm.
And which I thought was, holy Christmas. here I am, 19 years old, and this company's going to send me to New Hampshire to manage a shoe store. Okay, we'll give it a try. And, the money was actually pretty good at the time for me, and so I went. I did not have a vehicle. I traveled by bus. Did not rent an apartment. Got a cheap old hotel room. And so I was there for, it wasn't too long I was there, but at that time, leading up to that, I had gotten my notification that I was going to get drafted. And, so I said, there's not much I can do about it. That train is coming and I can't stop it. And, but then when they got a hold of me again, they found out that I was no longer in Vermont. I said, "Wow, you got to start all over. You got to go to a place in New Hampshire." And, okay. So I went to a place in New Hampshire, and so while I was there, then they did all their testing, and I guess they engaged in a fair amount of internal thoughts. What was going on, what the possible outcomes were. Like this whole thing with Vietnam was certainly becoming I would end up. You know, being 18, 19 years old, I said, okay, what's your life going to look like now, Doug? And I didn't know it. I guess it was the early beginnings of my streak of independence. I wanted to be in control of what was happening to me. I didn't want to necessarily give it to anybody else. And, if mistakes happened, they would be my mistakes. But I didn't want somebody else making mistakes for me. So, and as you may have remembered, when we were talking at that dinner the other night there, that, you know, I said, you know, I was so smart that I said I wasn't going to be drafted, because I would join the join the service. And I did. And, you know, did all the testing for the helicopter pilot stuff, and, you know, actually passed, despite them telling me that I didn't have a chance. It turns out I did, with the exception of my color vision.
Right.
And as I look back upon that, helicopter pilots had a pretty high rate of not coming back. So I says, it probably worked out for the best. And, so went through different things and ended up in military intelligence. That's how that all got started.
So you decide to volunteer before the draft can get you. What did your family think of this decision?
I don't think they were all that crazy about it, but I think they eventually understood my rationale for that.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, I would get a chance to go in the Army, have more choice over what it is that I was going to do in the Army, but I saw no way of escaping that. And I wasn't going to run away, and I wasn't going to head to Canada, so, you know, the belief is that you go in, pick up some skills in a setting that you might be able to apply and use afterwards. As it turns out, I think that was true. Very true. So.
Your first stop was going to be basic training. Where was this?
Basic training was in Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Tell me about Fort Dix, and when is this, 1964, 65?
It would have been, yeah, 65.
Okay. Tell me about training at Fort Dix. What's the place look like? What are you going through on a daily basis?
Well, it was really, you know, I was not impressed. I mean, it was run down, in pretty poor condition. It was early stages of winter. It was cold. And, you know, people were getting sick. It was just plain, flat out miserable. You know, and having these people that was supposed to be making the tough soldier ready. All they were doing was hollering and screaming at you, and, you know, doing the marching, push-up, sit-up, you know, all that stuff. And I suspect most of the people that I was with were going, well, where is all of this leading to? And it was kind of humorous along the way. But, well, at any rate, now, the, you know, basic training company or group that I was in was a pretty big mixture of racial and cultural people from around the country, the East Coast. And I was therefore being exposed to those differences in a way that I had never, ever experienced before, ever. Those differences between our cultures and races.
Tell me about those differences. What sort of things are you seeing? What sort of things are you doing?
Well, the African Americans pretty much hung to themselves, and so did the Latinos. There was things that were being said by all the groups against the others that I found pretty foreign in terms of thought process. I never really grew up having really negative thoughts about people of a different culture or race than my own. Early on, when it came down to picking a bunkmate, you know, who you're going to have as your bunkmate, I didn't ever figure out what the hell difference it would make, but apparently it made a lot of difference to a lot of people. You know, I ended up agreeing and selecting that my bunkmate would be a black guy. We got along pretty good. So, I mean, I don't know. I never dawned on me to wonder what the hell did he think that he ended up the white guy for a bunch of things. I don't know. But I guess it was, you know, then it kind of dawned on me that there's a lot of stuff going on in this world that I don't know anything about. So I had to really pay attention.
So, were there any repercussions from either the blacks or the whites?
None that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
But where things really shined for me, it was really funny. New Jersey during this time, and it was November, December, was getting a fair amount of snow. And the only way they could move the troops around down here was with what I guess you'd call them, a small deuce and a half pickup truck. They weren't the multi-fuel tandem axle ones, there, like Ford or Dodges. And but with all the snow and everything else coming around, we're all standing outside in the snow, coming down on us and everything else. We're all freezing our backsides off. And the sergeant says, "All right, all of you people that can have driven to the snow, take one step forward." Okay, I step forward. Well, hell, never had developed the thought process that never volunteer for anything.
Yeah, that's going through my head right now.
But I hadn't learned that. Well, this was early on in basic training. I hadn't learned that you don't volunteer. It was not like volunteer KP duty or anything like that, but it's amazing. So I step forward, and there really wasn't a whole bunch of us that stepped forward, and I says, "Okay, you are hereby an authorized military driver." Okay. What the hell have I gotten myself into? Well, it's because we've had experience in driving around the snow that they're now going to put us behind the wheel of the truck and have us drive around the snow and be driving our fellow recruits around in the snow. So, well, good. Well, I'm using a chance to kill a whole bunch of people. But as it turned out, you know, I could drive the snow. And oh yeah, you had to know how to drive a standard shift.
Sure.
So I could do that. And so I think my credentials kind of took a step up as far as the rest of the troops are considered. You know, halfway decent guy, he's not bad, drives, he's not going to kill us, he gets us through the snow, maybe he's okay. You know, so, little did I know about that military license would stick with me through the rest of my time in the military. You know, when I got to Vietnam, the only ones that ever drove any vehicles were those that possessed a military license. Be a long time before somebody else would give you one. You know, so. And that was okay, too.
Yeah. Kind of a positive development that you did not expect. Yeah. And take me through your daily routine at boot camp. What sort of things are you experiencing? What sort of things are you seeing? What's going on there for Dix?
Well, it was, you know, up early, you know, marching, exercising, there was some sort of classroom stuff going on. A lot of nomenclature, introduction, a lot of time was spent introduction to firearms. But one of the things that happened to at least the company that I was in was a lot of illness. And I just want to say meningitis. And so I spent a lot of time taking precautions to reduce the threat of it spreading. There was a lot of people ended up in the hospital. And we learned how to put up what I think they called a sneeze curtain on the individual bunks. And it was sort of like a poncho that was put up in a triangular shape at the head of the bunk so that during, you know, sleep time, that if you were sneezing or coughing or something, that it would stop it from being spread. But I ended up sick. I did about a week in a hospital setting. And it was right during the time frame when they were doing firearms and things like that. So I lost out a lot of that. And as it turns out, when I got done and got back and everything else, the sergeants were having conversations with me about that I'd missed so much of the... Well, first of all, you got to go through the whole process of when you, report the sick bed. There isn't a person in the building that believes that you are telling the truth. If you're saying that you're sick, they don't believe you.
It's their job to not believe you.
If you're coughing, you're making it up. You're cold-booking. You're just the worst thing. They kick you in the ass and tell you to get back. And, wow. And they take your temperature and find out it's 102, 103, and says, well, maybe you are telling the truth. But anyway, so then I get back from the hospital and everything else, and they're off to the firing range, getting ready to go through their end of their rifle training. So then they say, we'll help you here, but we gotta let you know that if you don't do good on this, then you may have to, redo it. In other words, you'll stay behind and go through the next class.
Mm-hmm. Recycling, I believe, is the phrase.
I'm sorry?
I think recycling is the phrase.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
And that didn't sound like a good thing to me. So I told my sergeant, I says, look, you're right. I haven't spent a lot of time with these rifles, but I've got several rifles at home. They may not be necessarily as good as this one, but they're pretty good. And, I can shoot. I can shoot good. And so he says, well, we'll give you a chance to see if you can do that. So I got down there and I, had some time to get kind of like reacclimated a little bit. And then I went through the routine, myself and a few other people who were in the same boat. I was knocking down targets like there was nothing to it. I said, okay, how am I doing? He says, you're doing good. So, no recycle for him. And these bouts of illnesses and sicknesses and everything else continued, and apparently somewhere along the line the Army made a decision that keeping all these people here at Fort Dix and trying to force them to stay through the end of the basic training is all we're doing, is getting them all sick, spreading the meningitis and other illnesses all over the place. Send them all home, give them a break. So they ended the basic training, I think, at least 2 weeks early. And we jumped on a train and headed home. stayed home for a couple of weeks. And he left with the assignments to wherever he was going to go for, you know, advanced training.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this before we get you to your next station.
Yeah.
You talked about the physical part of it. What about the mental part of basic training? Did you understand what they're trying to do? And if so, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, I understood it. I was young enough and wouldn't call myself a great athlete, but I was athletic, and so I could pretty much hold my own. And I knew it was important. I knew intuitively that it was important for all of us to have a good understanding of what it is to be confronted with difficult living situations. But also, we all had to work together to accomplish goals. But I, you know, as I look back upon it, that, you know, that whole basic training thing was just thoroughly messed up. But we were learning that even though it doesn't necessarily make sense on the surface, the military regime of how everybody gets treated the same was important. What it was that we could expect in terms of good order of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, I look back on it, it was more about a means to get to the end. And, just to hang in there, get to the end, you'll be all right.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much how I did it. I didn't come away from there with any friendships with any specific people, and I didn't go with anybody that way either, so.
Right. You mentioned that you got to go home after basic training. Was this around the holiday season?
Yep. Just before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like to be home after this this training at Fort Dix?
I guess it was, I really don't have any great thoughts about that. It was kind of, the best thing I could say is that it was, there was a possibility that I was, then it became even more apparent that Vietnam was probably something that was in my future. So I just enjoyed what I had at home, and what few friends, close friends that I had, we talked a little bit. But a lot of them were going to school, so it wasn't affecting them. So I kind of felt I was the lone guy in the clubhouse there, just. I'm going to go off to war, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of thought to myself, well, maybe, but you may graduate and still have to go, so I don't know.
Okay. Sure. You mentioned Vietnam. What did you know about Vietnam at this point, even before you go to advanced training? What did you know about what was going on over there?
Well, I knew there was what I was learning, and I know now that I was not learning well. There was a fair amount of opposition to the war, but it was promoted anyways to the average person, I guess, as being communists trying to take over things. And it was the U.S. policy to prevent that from happening, and that these people were really bad people. I guess my approach was, I hear you and everything else, but I'm not necessarily seeing anything that makes me jump up and down and pound my chest, so I mean, we're just going to go with the flow here and see what happens.
Yeah. after the holidays, you report. You report where? Where did you go next for your advanced training?
Right to Fort Halliburton. I had a one-way ticket because I was a regular Army, which made me a rare bird in a field full of draftees. So I got to get into that line, and went a whole bunch of us, and headed to Fort Halliburton. And I don't recall ever seeing any draftees being there, although I'm sure there were.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your time at Fort Halliburton. What are you going to be doing there?
Well, that was, you know, more of the military stuff than anything else. We got lucky or unlucky. We ended up with the class that I was in, we ended up with a Marine sergeant for the, company commander or whatever. I'm thinking to myself, I need somebody to help me understand this. I'm in the Army, I'm wearing an Army uniform, and I've got this short, sawed-off Marine sergeant who looks like he wants to chew nails, and he wants to holler and scream at me and everybody else. Where is this? Why is this happening? And his goal in life was to give us Army guys a regime in which we would be stronger and better, and he wanted us to march and be the best marchers on the compound. And Fort Halliburton was pretty small. You could stand in the center of Fort Halliburton and see all four sides without any problem. It was like a small college campus that had college buildings and dorm rooms like a college would have. It was on Colgate Creek, and it was probably one of the first sites of a place that qualified for Superman cleanup. The odors and the stuff that was in the creek was terrible. But life went on. So that was, you know, in many respects, kind of like a collegiate campus affair. We'd have classes during the day. Nighttime, there'd be some entertainment. I can't remember, but I think we were able to get off the fort for limited times. So that means there was an opportunity to go places for socialization. And weekends, some guys that were really close, they'd rent a car and go home on weekends. Me, Baltimore to Vermont, that's not going to happen, but I could go out and about. Go downtown Baltimore and get, you know, non-Army food, get drinks and everything else. Nobody seemed to care if you were 18, 19, 20. It didn't make any difference. But so you almost had a college-like atmosphere. That was good. And so I knew what I was doing at the time, you know. Classes in interrogation techniques, things that you should and should not do. Some people that had spent a limited amount of time already in Vietnam that came back and passed on some of their experiences. In retrospect, it was fairly accurate, but not entirely so. Because they were, the teachings and everything else were designed to, you know, get interrogators who were going to be really out in the bush and things like that. And then there was no real thought at that time that was relayed to us that some of us could very well be in a unit like the 519th, and that we would be a much larger organization, and we would have definite roles to play in terms of interrogation. And I also did some schooling for intelligence analysts. This kind of gave me a double MOS, and I found that to be very interesting. And, you know, you're given information, you're given scenarios that you have to work up, you know. So you can see A, B, C, but what does it really mean? And the value of that is that you could be talking to various people and looking at different information and looking at different things. And does that mean that there are BC here or MBA here? Not that any of that was specifically addressed in the training. It was just a concept of what it is that you were looking at. It was also an introduction to how the military defines units and strengths of units and organization, you'd have the unit designations and what they mean and the symbols that would go along with describing them. You could apply it to not only U.S. forces, but you could apply it to foreign forces. So there was a lot of education stuff going on there. One part of that time there that really bothered me and disappointed me a great deal was that I volunteered, if I volunteer again, if I wanted to, do some language learning. In other words, what I'd like to learn to speak Vietnamese. And I said, sure, I'll do that. Then they give you the kicker. So, well, if you do that and you can get through this, we're going to have to ask you to add a year onto your enlistment. And I said, yeah, sure, okay. And my rationale for that was, here I go, I'm thinking again. Is that, if I do that, at the end, I had no thoughts in my mind that the war in Vietnam would end in 2 years or 3 years. So it would more than likely always be an opportunity to use that language some other time and place. And so I did. And I think I participated in about 2 weeks of classes. And whatever criteria they were using at the time, I guess I didn't pass the muster on it. I said, thank you very much. So it's okay. I find it ironic because many years later, in late 70s, early 80s, when I was finishing up my college degree education, I took Chinese. And, I did good with it. I don't know. Maybe it was the teacher. Maybe it was the student. I don't know.
Any number of things.
It was interesting.
Well, I'm curious here, Doug. They're training you to be a field interrogator. What does this training look like? How do they approach you to, or approach teaching you how to do this? What kinds of techniques are they offering? Take me through that kind of interrogation training.
I'm not so sure I can I'm not sure I can tell it.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
Not because I don't want to, it's just I'm not so sure I can recall any of those specifics.
Sure, yeah. Sure, that's no problem.
Now, I mean, there's certain things, it was about asking questions, looking at the person you're doing an interrogation with, and you could be interrogating an actual prisoner, you could be interrogating a suspected DC, suspected NVA, and it very well could be a farmer. So they would spend a lot of time talking about the different characteristics that could be seen out in the field. You know, if you look at I wouldn't have known, but using my interpreter, you could determine if the person you talked to was a North Vietnamese or a South Vietnamese, for the simple reason that they had different accents that were obviously undiscernible to me. But it's sort of like me talking to you in Texas. You in Texas know that I am not from Texas.
Right.
So the same kind of, thought process going on. Looking at the color of their skin, is another giveaway. Where are their calluses on their hands and their legs and their knees and things like that? And just how nervous are they? Learning those things. The other thing that they spent a lot of time on is to make sure that we were not using any means of torture, or I guess the word not used then, but would be used now, enhanced interrogation techniques. And a lot of good jokes were passed on about throwing people out of a helicopter. I'm sure you've heard the one where they're in the process of interrogating a bunch of DC, NVA, and then they take them on a helicopter flight and asking them questions, and nobody would answer the question, so they throw a guy out the door of the helicopter, and then they go to the next guy and say, okay, what's the name of your unit? Where's your commander? Where are you going? Blah, blah, blah. And he would respond, don't ask me. You just threw the captain out the door.
Right.
So, it's a humorous way to learn that your actions have consequences.
Sure, but, sure.
So for the most part, I think the people that I associated with, especially the ones that came through the Hollaberg and approach the interrogations in a more professional manner, were pretty successful in getting the information that was beneficial to the Army and trying to put together a bigger picture. So I guess that's the one thing that stood out in my mind.
Did they give you any training on how to work with an interpreter?
No, I do not recall any of that. When things really came clear for me, I'll jump forward a little bit to when we got to Vietnam. We got to Vietnam, we settled in, and we went to what I have since learned is they call the Parker House. Crappy compound out on the Bin Laden Bridge. I wasn't there for that long before we moved to another location, but when we started doing our interrogation stuff, it was an OJT process in which we were working alongside of and with experienced interrogators that are already in the country. And so I remember one of them just as clear as it was yesterday. Sedgwick Tourism. The guy's written several books. He was looked upon as a renowned expert on DC and NDA and how their organizations were composed and what their organization looked like and how many people and how they made them up. Even down at the village level, and, who became what. He spoke Vietnamese fluently, perfectly, and even stunned the Vietnamese, but because he sounded just like them. They had a hard time determining that he really was Vietnamese. But the part of the part of it was that, he married a Vietnamese and, stayed in Vietnam for a long time. After the war became, an integral part of things that were going on in Vietnam. A very talented person. He may have had some ideas that a lot of people disagreed with, but you cannot poo-poo any of the knowledge that he had. So, I stayed as close to him as I could and learned what I could and listened. And then the other way that things got to be better for me anyway is I made sure that I did the best I could to, if I had any choice in the matter, was that the interpreter that I had was that we would be compatible, and that there would be no animosity between us because I was American and he was Vietnamese. So, to make sure that we had the same goal. And I always demonstrated that I really had no desire in trashing some poor Vietnamese guy that didn't wanted to be there less than I wanted to be there.
Sure.
And to that extent, I was lucky. I had some very good interpreters that felt good relationships with, and a little bit even off the books. Not that anything juicy ever happened. It's just that. I wasn't taking advantage of any money or otherwise, and especially if the interpreter was a female. I had a female that was a lieutenant in the Arvin lieutenant, quite attractive and very sharp. We spent some time off duty together, but it was nothing. It was more professional, relaxed time than anything else. That was good. That made our continued relationship a lot easier.
How long does your training last at Fort Halliburton?
I got there first week or so in January of 66, if I'm not mistaken. And maybe stayed there until July, somewhere in that area, maybe June. And so then it was, got me another trip home. And I knew at that time that after Halliburton, I was headed for Fort Bragg.
Okay.
And which didn't mean a damn thing to me. I didn't know where it was other than North Carolina. know, and so that's good. Spent my time there, and then next thing you know, we took off for Fort Bragg. The groups were small, manageable groups. We were put up in standard wooden barracks. It was hotter than hell. Everybody opened all the windows to make sure the air conditioning worked. So we had some time with firearms, a lot of marching, and not much time on anything else. And, you know, I remember one time they had us out in areas that have some exercises where we would be examining, the underbrush and everything else, and there will always be some, green berets or whatever that would try to hide, and we were supposed to be able to try to see them. It was particularly difficult for me, which reinforced in my mind I was doing a good thing by going into military intelligence, because I'm colorblind.
Right.
And, a lot of them I wouldn't see. I think it's pretty difficult because I'm from Vermont and grow hunting, and I can generally see a deer in the woods, but it's entirely different. And but even some of the deer I don't see either. So we were spending our time like that, and we'd be doing like that. We spent a lot of time in the march, going through the woods and stuff like that. The end of our days were spent time in the showers. I always thought this was really, in the showers, we looked at each other all over to make sure that we didn't have any ticks on, and of course, everybody did. And everybody had their own way to get the ticks off, but you wanted to get the ticks off because you didn't want to get sick. Here we are, 40 years later, the tick disease up here in Vermont is, you don't want it, but it makes you sick for a long time.
Yeah, pretty nasty stuff.
And so we got to get along pretty good with everybody, and we knew that as time was getting along, we were getting close to finding out where we were all going. And all of us were, military intelligence people. And, so I thought it was kind of interesting that we were all put together in that group. I can't tell you how many people there were. It was several hundred. And eventually got towards the end, and the big muster, and guys came out and started calling off names and saying where they were going. It was then that I realized, there is a possibility that I could be going to some other places, like Japan, Korea, Germany, some other places where a lot of these people were going. And I'm going, I'm not so sure the interrogation part's going to work out good in Germany, but hey, if you want to send it to Germany, I'm all on board. But as life would have it, that was not to be the case. The majority of the people were in fact going to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And, so that was all done and over with. We got our orders and knew that we were headed to Vietnam. It wasn't too long after that that it pretty much worked out how it was scheduled for us to get there. And I'm sure you've heard different people explain different ways how we all get to Vietnam. And, we eventually took a boat out of Oakland, but to get to that boat, we had to show up full combat group, you know, backpacks, duffel bags, helmets, rifles, everything. And I showed up at Polk Air Force Base. They put us on a charter jet, and they were flying us to, stopped along the way because there was something that had to be attended to on our plane, and they landed in Chicago at O'Hare International. On that particular time frame when we made that flight, it was during the time, and I can't remember the dates, but it was the midsummer when the airlines went on strike. So a plane landing in Chicago at O'Hare was kind of unusual. Taxiing up to an air terminal was even all the more unusual. And whoever was in charge said, all right, you guys want to stretch your legs and get off and walk around? Okay. But you got to be back here by whatever. And I'm going, these guys are pretty brave. They're going to let us off a plane. Every single one of us is headed to Vietnam. And if you were ever going to think of having an opportunity to not go to Vietnam, this would be the time, you know, if you were inclined to do that. But here we are, a bunch of us, I mean, a plane, 707 at the time, carry what, maybe 120, 160 people, walking on the airport, helmets, rifles, and everything else. All the poor civilians are going, all right, what just happened? Have I been transported to a Twilight Zone thing or whatever, you know? So we did that, got back on the plane, and to the best of my knowledge, nobody beats you. And so we did. And we made it in up the West Coast. Buses picked us up, took us to a barrack situation. We stayed there for 2-3 days. I spent a lot of time making sure that our medical records and different things were up to snuff. We didn't have shots, we got them. And the Army was very good about making sure we got shot. It didn't make any difference how many you thought you had, they were going to make sure that you had them. And eventually then we put on buses again and taken down to a dock and got onto a ship. And away we went.
What was the ship, do you remember?
It was an old World War II troop carrier. The name of it was the USS General Hugh Cathy.
Okay.
And,
tell me what you do on this trip. It's like a 3-week trip to get to Vietnam. Tell me about this time.
A lot of it was getting through the seasickness. More of it was that the different groups would have different times up on deck doing exercises. And that was about it. A lot of it was social time. There was a lot of card playing going on. A lot of just plain ordinary social activities, you know, talking to people that were in your unit about what was going on. You know, putting up with the BS that the merchant marines would try to pull.
Like what?
Well, at least with the ship that we were on, they'd have fun. They would throw a life preserver overboard. Life preserver aboard, we would activate a lighting system, so the ship had no choice. They had to make a big turn and come back and locate the life preserver and make sure there was nobody attached to it. You know, the thoughts are that somebody went overboard. You know, and all that did was just really slow things down. You know, turning a 300-foot ship around in the middle of the ocean is not necessarily easy. And that happened several times. And I was pretty pleased that one of the guys in the 519, he saw one of the merchant marines do it and turned him in. Cool. And then we have a chance to stop in the Philippines at Maha Harbor. And here's another thing. They had, I know it's a big island, but they let us off. They let us off the boat. Because we've already been through two typhoons. So things are pretty rough. And, so they let us off. Buses that we could take to go to PXs and other things. And so we got our legs, got some real food, and I don't know of anybody that did not come back. But again, that would have been another opportunity. So, you know, that's how that went. And then from there on into Vietnam, it was pretty smooth sailing. Then we spent damn near close to a week along the coast of Vietnam. We went in up north, somewhere near Hue, and certain units would get off and go ashore, and then we moved down to another location. I think we were the third or the fourth. We got off at Bung Tao. I think in every place we stopped, we didn't pull into a deep port where you could pull into a dock. They used landing craft, you know, World War II landing craft type things. So you climbed down the side of the ship with those nets, and you got all that stuff that you brought with you. You're hanging on to that and going down the nets at the same time. So that was fun. Then you get on land, and okay, that's good. And they'd march you to the place where they'd set you down, and we waited for airplanes to come and pick us up. And they used C-123s. We sat in the sun in that sandy beach area next to the runway, and we stayed there for hours and just planes flat out. We hadn't been exposed to any of those temperatures, and that was well over 100. And that was a brutal day. You know, a lot of guys got burnt. You know, you'd cover up your skin, but you couldn't get it all covered up. Not a fun day.
A welcome to Vietnam kind of moment.
Yeah, it was a real welcome. And there wasn't any relief for a long time. Plane, Tofanut, and then I think into Deuce and a Half, to our compound out in the village of Illinois. So, welcome. But there's a lot of stuff I've left off, I'm sure.
Well, let's stop there for today, Doug. That takes us to a good point. This is Kelly Greger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Doug Hoyt. Today is 6 December 2019. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Hoyt is joining me by telephone from Montpelier, Vermont. Okay, Doug, you've just arrived in Saigon. Take me with you throughout this this new venture you're going on, adventure you're going on.
Yeah.
What are we seeing? What's going on in Saigon when you arrive?
Well, most of this is just a little fuzzy, but when we arrived in country, we got settled into what some people are calling the Parker compound.
Mm-hmm.
It was an old French place out on the river. And there was a rudimentary wooden barracks, where we stayed. There was rows of bunk beds, and that was it. And I think there was a period of time that was some checking in, getting acclimated, making sure all our records were in order. And then the 519th contributed to different operations under the umbrella of the 525th. And, for instance, the group that I was with was, CMIC, a Combined Military Interrogation Center. And others were in other areas, but despite the length of time that I was there, I never really got a chance to learn exactly what they were doing. But for the interrogation part, we started going to the area where the interrogations were being conducted.
And was that there on the Parker compound?
No. It was a travel by mostly by Dusenat.
Okay, so wherever they were, you were needed is where you were called to go.
No. There was the the very beginnings of a combined interrogation center.
Okay.
And we eventually went to an area in Cholon, in Saigon. I don't know how far away that was from the barracks, but it involved a pretty good sized trip. I'm going to say it was a good half an hour plus to make it. Of course, you really couldn't travel anywhere in Saigon with any hope of doing it quickly. The congestion was just unbelievable. There was absolutely no resemblance of, from our perspective, no resemblance of any order in traffic, traffic laws. Everybody for themselves. But where we ended up is a small, very quiet section of Cholon. It's a very residential area. My recollection is that there was a lot of walls, old walls, and a lot of trees, shade, some old buildings. And we were kind of like been off on a side street where there were some houses that had been there for a while. But in the middle of all this, there was a series of tents. And there was desks and various things inside the tents that were occupied by U.S. soldiers, Vietnamese soldiers, Vietnamese civilians who were doing clerical stuff. And off in the corner in some of these tents were the actual interrogations were taking place, kind of like out in the open, for all practical purposes. So then there was other different places in that area that were inside of small buildings where some interrogations were also taking place. Now, I have no recollection of where these people were kept or how they ended up there. And it just didn't dawn on me at the time, I guess. But I guess my main purpose then was to learn how the process of interrogations began, what you did, and what you did with what you learned. And so I guess I have a very faint, if practically non-existent, memory of some of that stuff. Other than that, was a place we went to every day, and we began, with the assistance of an interpreter, talking to various people. We had certain say criteria, but we had keys that we would focus on. And, it was kind of freewheeling, sort of like what you and I are doing now. You just started off by talking with the person, kind of their name, and where they're from, what they're doing, you just worked off of that, and whatever was said was, something that you could use to move on to another part.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I think, the more I think, I'm thinking about it, was concentrating on trying to weed out the DC from the North Vietnamese. And at the time, at those stages, in 66, mostly DC, they were trying to learn which organizations they were attached to, and if so, what were the names of their leaders, who was in charge, who were the political people, who were the cadre, learning all that information. Of building a database of what was in the area.
Mm-hmm.
It was all put together, you could end up with a pretty good picture of what units were where and how strong they were and what they had for equipment and so forth. So it was all a learning experience for me anyway.
Well, you'd had some training in this. How do you approach your work? I mean, you say okay, it's kind of like what we're doing right now, asking questions and following up on that. But do you go in with a specific set of questions? Do you go in with a specific group of things that you want to know? And how do you bring that about? What's your strategy and tactics in this?
I don't know. I don't recall ever having a cheat sheet to work on. There might have been some discussions with more senior officers or senior enlisted in terms of what you might want to be looking for. But it was kind of open, and it was being done, and pretty much like you just said, the way you and I are talking. I mean, you might have a list of some things that you want to go over, but in the process of talking or interrogating this person, you were keeping in mind statements that would serve as a springboard to go in a different direction,
mm-hmm.
based on what the person was saying. So while it seemed freewheeling, you really were just looking for information, and any information is good.
Yeah.
But again, the focus was on and letting someone like law enforcement training come in, but they were using it then. They may have even said it, but it's the five W's. who, what, when, where, why. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you just, if you had the gift of gab, and you had somebody that was talking to you, you could really cover a lot of territory. Never, ever did I ever have a sense that people that were being interrogated were trying to mislead us or lying. Were they always truthful? No. But I always found them very willing to talk. And for the most part, at least in that situation that we were involved in, they were treated fairly well. And I heard stories and seen where some were not treated well, and I'm not so sure it always ended very well.
Never saw any of that firsthand, though?
No, I did not. I've heard of people saying that, but no, I can't say that.
I've talked to others in a somewhat similar kind of business that you were in, and they've expressed that the Vietnamese interrogations of communist enemy were considerably different than the American approach. Did you see anything like that?
No, I can't say that I did. I did not participate in any Arvin interrogations or anything like that. Interpreters that I had, most of them were Arvin soldiers, but I didn't see them getting really antsy about getting on the other side of treating the person appropriately. But bear in mind, we knew very well that the Arvin interpreters, their real responsibility was to share any information that we may have learned from a particular prisoner. So they were always interested in what I was doing. So it was good for them to get good information that we may have gotten, if they make it pass it on. But I don't think we got too anxious about them passing that information on. The information was the information. There's no big secrets there.
Do you go into these with any real understanding, any sort of information, intel on who these guys are, what you certainly suspect that they've been up to, and hoping to corroborate anything, or is it just someone has found someone, you sit down and talk to them to find out what you can find out?
Yeah, from my perspective, that's how it all started. Much later on, when the new combined center opened up, things became a little more organized in the sense that one side of the compound would belong to South Vietnamese, the other side belonged to us. We had our own support. They had their support. We could very well be interrogating the same people, but we could be getting different information. Not necessarily in a bad sense. We may have been focusing on other issues. I can't remember at what point, but at some point during that, I was put in one group, and I was part of a team. I can't remember what the name of the team was, but our area of concentration was the North Vietnamese quarter of battle. And when we were in CMIC doing interrogation, we were generally working with the prisoners that came from the North, that were associated with the North. And our whole goal was to learn about North Vietnam. And to that extent, we concentrated on things, what life was like for them in North Vietnam, what kind of education they have, what their real ages were, what kind of training, preparation, equipment, how they managed to move from one location to another. And particularly one of our goals was also to learn about the prisoners, American POW. How many, where are they? Have you ever been to, a prison? What are the conditions like? Even got to the point where you could get somebody that has some information, you could start drawing up some pretty good overlays of what the prisons look like and where they were located.
And what kind of prisons are we talking about?
Individual, locations were the American POWs were kept in, south, and inside a structure. We talked about defenses as well. Did you ever see an American POW? Yes, no. Yes or no. If he did, where, what did he look like? And you'd get a lot of, you'd do a lot of questions. Did he, tied up? Did he look healthy? Everything that you want to know about the prisoner and the conditions.
So are you asking for anything from Hoa Lo Prison in Hanoi down to a jungle camp, something like that?
Yeah, everything and anything.
Mm-hmm. How forthright, how truthful do you feel that they were? How easy were they to get information from?
Maybe I'm gullible, but I was pretty convinced that for the most part, they were pretty truthful.
What gives you that impression?
It's just that you could go back and double check with them again and get them another chance to interview them again or follow up and try to pull out the same information that you did before but do it in a different way. And so if they could consistently tell you something, then your level of confidence increases. A liar is always a liar, no matter what they're doing. You have a hard time telling the same story twice.
Mm-hmm. Was it SOP to meet with these people on more than one occasion, just to kind of?
I don't think it was SOP. It just just worked out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that I. Positive that I, did interrogate the same person at different times. And they would also be interrogated by another person, another interrogator, who may ask similar questions and could very well get the same information.
And you found that typically be the case.
I don't recall any designed scenario where Doug would ask the number of guard towers at Sante, and then Pete would come in a couple of days later and ask the same question. Just go away. I never had Well, they had a list of what to look for. Again, like I said at the beginning, it was all about spinning off of what you got out of the interrogation.
Was there any effort to follow up on this in terms of, okay, this guy told us this, this is what we're reporting, coming back and, you know, double-checking your sources, corroborating evidence, finding out that he was being truthful or no?
I don't know. I can't tell you on that, Kelly. My recollection, we just kept going through people as quickly as we could. Late 66, 67, and early 68, and most of 68, we were probably, by 68, the peak of, or damn close to the peak of, American MI people assigned. And there was just an awful lot of prisoners. Very short period of time to go through. But, your archive is going to have a ton of reports. And all of those reports were generally, written by the interrogator and, processed. And from there they went to another level. And I suspect at that level somebody was, pulling out different pieces of information and putting it together with other interrogations of other people looking for similar information on similar events and places and things. And by then, the picture started becoming a little more clear.
Tell me about the conditions in which you interrogated prisoners. I think some people would probably think, okay, bare room, bare swinging light bulb, that kind of thing, which may or may not be true. I've got no idea. Tell me about the conditions.
Well, it was, in many respects, just about like that, with the exception of it was a very simple room, desk, a couple of chairs, no windows. That was the extent of it. You did your interrogation there. I don't recall any decorations or anything there to make it look kind of homey or anything like that. It was pretty sterile. And when you're in the field in an operation room, you just kind of got next to your favorite tree and sat down and did it there.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody and their brother could see what you were doing. They could see that the person was, being interrogated, but they may not be sure. Now, because who are these Americans and other people talking to this person?
Mm-hmm.
And why? Now, he could be a prisoner, but he could also very well just be a refugee that got snapped up. That's when we really did a lot of freewheeling on operations.
Tell me about that freewheeling.
You sat down and started talking, and you tried to identify them as to who they were and where they come from. And obviously, no way to prove it. So whatever they were saying was something that you worked with. But, again, if they were trying to tell you that they were, rice farmers, they had no physical demonstration that they were, in fact, a farmer. And, things kind of went downhill from there until they came around sort of thing. That I'm talking, if you could catch them in a lie, and catch them being untruthful, and really win at them on that, and challenge them, eventually come around and talk to you. And the average soldier, average NVA, average PC, and everything else, really weren't crazy about being, in the position that they were in, and notwithstanding being captured. But they really weren't in favor of doing this for love of country and so forth. Forced into doing it. Bad things could happen to their relatives, to their family members, if they didn't. And when we were concentrating on PC operations, again, it was all, how did you come to be a DC? I had to. Otherwise, bad things would happen to my family. The pressure that the upper echelons of the DC would apply to the villagers was severe, and so they were pretty well stuck between a rock and a hard place. Either cooperate with the VC and become a member of the VC, or else they're going to get you. And when you get done doing that, you got to watch out for the Arvin and or the U.S., because if they come along, they could just easily kill you as not, because you're a VC. So you're really stuck. Who are you going to get killed by? You're going to get killed by the Americans, you're going to get killed by the DC. Not a very pleasant position to be in.
Sure.
Now, when we first got here, this, I'm going to say this happened late fall of 66. I'm going to say somewhere around November, somewhere in there, and I was out and about in the compound, and then I recall a commotion taking place near the gate, so I went over and looked at the gate and everything else, and there was a bunch of Vietnamese women and children that were at the gate, and they needed to come in because they were claiming that they were hurt and injured and everything else. But their little village had been attacked by the VC, and you could always hear little episodes of gunfire and little explosions off in the distance while you're in the compound. But it was nighttime, it was dark and everything else, and they came in and they were looking for help for them and their wounded. And their story was that they were attacked by the VC and punished for some reason or another. And so they turned to us to look for help, the help they needed. I mean, I remember clearly one of the wounded was a baby, maybe 2-year-old. It had a chest wound, and it was alive, was bleeding. And so a bunch of us all got together to start helping to take care of him. So somebody made a decision, an NCO made a decision that we would get these people to the nearest Vietnamese, what we call a hospital or express care or whatever, someone that could take care of them, and that we would assist them in doing that. So we loaded up into the jeeps and some 3/4 tons, and we took them with us, and we went there, and I held this baby chest next to mine, and help stop the bleeding, and we got there. And so a nurse or whatever took the baby from me. So then we were helping the medical people tend to the other people that were wounded. And I have a very clear memory of helping take care of this woman who herself had some chest and leg wounds. And, you know, she lay there, you just kind of like held her hand, talked to them, because they weren't giving them a lot of pain medicine. And while somebody else was trying to dig out the pieces of shrapnel, turns out that they were using, the VC were using captured grenade launcher, and it used the grenade launchers against people in this village. And so, you know, that particular woman had, you know, shrapnel from that. And God bless them, they just kind of laid there and took it. And, you know, you can see them wincing and everything else, but extremely tough. Yet at the same time, very appreciative for the help they were getting. So a little part of the war says, you know, these people just minding their own business, but because they will not, you know, participate and subscribe to whatever it is the VC is trying to get them to do, they in turn get punished. Some of us get killed. Don't know if any or how many may have been killed in that little attack, but it happened.
What became of this mother and the child?
You know, they were, you know, taken to additional treatment there at that location, and our need for being there was really no longer. And so we went back to the compound, and that was the end. You know, I never saw anything or heard anything more about any of them from that point on. It was just like, yep, one of those things.
Who's in charge of administering the prisoners?
Don't know.
All right. Say you've, let's go back to your early days there in Saigon. Take me into the unit. What's it like to be the new guy in this unit? These guys have been doing this for a while. You know, you're the FNG as it goes. What's it like to come into a unit full of people that you're perhaps not all that familiar with in this different environment?
Well, for me and the guys that I came with, we were it. We weren't the first, we were the most. So there was more of us than there were of people that have been there before us. And the ones that were there before us had only been there, a month or two more than us. So they were just as much in the dark as we were. And so it was never, in my mind, it was never a question about, you know, who did more or knew more. It was, we were all pretty much in the same boat. We're all still trying to learn what we're doing and where we're going and how we're getting there. Things got a little turned sideways for me. Things were going along pretty good in terms of getting to and from the compound to the interrogation center in Cholon and doing those things. And we got to the point where we knew our way around enough. We were allowed to leave the compound for social time. And we'd all, come back to the compound and, little teeny Renault taxis or whatever. We may or may not have had too much to drink. enjoyed the night out. You get up, go to work the next day, and it was beginning to act and feel like a regular 9-to-5 job, although it really wasn't a 9-to-5. But I mean, there was some routine to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about that. Take me through a typical day for you. What's the routine? I mean, from the time you get out of the rack in the morning to the time you head back at night, if that was your schedule. Tell me step by step what a day was like for you.
Well, kind of like I told you, or may have told you, maybe you aren't there. It bothers me to no end, and I cannot for the life of me remember what I did for breakfast. I have absolutely zero memory of that. And, I know there had to be something that resembled breakfast. Now, you can call me anything, but just don't call me late for food. And I have no memory of it. But, something tells me that it had to happen. I was not a coffee drinker, so that didn't bother me. But there had to be a form of mess hall in which you grab your breakfast. And as I'm saying that, I'm thinking that's probably what happened, but I don't have a clear memory of it. We then get into vehicles and head off, patrol on, do our thing there in terms of getting together with prisoners, talking individually with the prisoners and an interpreter, going through those things, a lot of note-taking, and then following that, there'd be a time for lunch. We were very close to downtown Cholon, so we just jump in vehicles and go down to downtown Cholon, and you'd either get something to eat on the open market, or there was any number of hotels that were either BOQs or BEQs, in which they had mess halls, and I kind of liked those, and a lot of us liked those. You'd go there and get a decent lunch. At the end of the day, you could go there and get a good supper. And at the end of that, then you're free to do what you wanted to do, pretty much. And then you'd make your way back to the compound. And that pretty much underscored how the day went. And there had to be some sort of criteria about taking off and leaving the compound and going out. But again, I don't have a good memory of that, other than I know that I went out many times. And that was pretty much how things were going along. But then Tet comes around every year. I'm pretty sure it's in February. I had my share of guard duty, and I was scheduled to go on duty this one particular night, but I was feeling really, really bad as the day wore on, and it was time to go. I just, went and reported that I couldn't do it. I was not well, and I had a fever. It was really bad. They got a medic and checked me out, and I had a very high fever. So the decision was that this was on the eve of Tet, and so we were all on locked compound. Nobody could leave the compound. You know, clear instructions to stay off the streets, don't go out, don't go anywhere. No army vehicles out. But they made a decision that I was sick enough that I need to go to the hospital. And so everybody got their helmets and their vests and got their rifles. When I say everybody, there was probably about five guys. And then they put me in the ambulance. And I'm the only person that doesn't have a rifle, doesn't have a helmet, doesn't have a vest. And I could give a crap. I was terrible. And the same as always, you know, they're accusing you of trying to get out of guard duty. Such is not the case. Medic said, no, he's really sick. So I think at the time I was running a temp of 103.
Mm.
And so off to the third field hospital, and got there, he stretched me in, asked me a lot of questions, and I recall being somewhat delirious. They'd taken my temperature and it was climbing. Next thing I know, they got me on a, they're cutting my clothes off and taking them off, and they got me on a, like a poncho, and they were putting ice on it, and trying to lower my temp. And I guess I peaked out at something like 105.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. That's what they were telling me. They said, you're close to dying. Well, thanks for the news. Turns out they got everything slowed down a little bit. I do not recall what they were giving me, for medication or anything like that. They told me, we're going to put you in this isolation ward. Nobody's going to be coming in, and you don't get visitors. And I'm just going to leave you in here because we do not know what you have.
I'll be darned.
And called it fever, F-U-O, fever unknown origin.
Right.
And I was there for about 2 weeks. I lost a tremendous amount of weight. And I didn't have, at that time, I didn't have weight to give up. 160, and I probably got down to 130, something like that. Not healthy, not at all healthy. But the good news is that it eventually got to the end, and they got me all cleared, and I recall a lot of testing and everything else. It could have been malaria, but they weren't positive. There's so many diseases over here that we just don't know.
Yeah.
And so then it was time to go home. Yeah, home. Meaning back to the company. I was taken out to this container, Connex container. And I had to dig into there to try to find my uniform, which was really no longer. So anyway, I ended up with some clothes, and I made it back to, somebody got me back to the compound, and I settled down, and took me a few days to get acclimated. So I don't think I did any interrogations for a while.
Hmm.
And, just further recovery. But, oh yeah, now I've got my I did not go back to the compound. While I was in the field hospital, everybody moved, not everybody, the CMIC guys moved out of the compound and went to their new quarters, which is close to Thompson, but not quite there. That's when we had what we called the hotel. went in there and they had a room all set up, and they brought my stuff down and put it there, and everything's all there. So that's where I spent my time getting myself back in shape. Mm. Then, so my next interrogation was done at the combined center, which is brand new and just opened up. So I got there and I was getting all acclimated to that, and, you know, reacquainting myself with team members and, you know, picking my desk out and, you know, all that stuff. So it was same old stuff, just in a different facility, much nicer, much neater, and life went on.
I would assume you would still be going out in the field as well, is that correct?
Yeah. We, as a group, would go on field operations, and it would be in support of whatever operation was taking place. Cedar Falls is one that comes to mind. Two other big operations that we went on. One operation, they loaded us all up and we went to Thompson and got on C-130s. Flew into that one. Another one, we got together with the other units that we were traveling with. And I think this one was, I can't remember. But it was all, that was by ground travel. We brought what vehicles we needed in terms of Jeeps and three-quarters and trailers and tents and things like that. And, big convoy out of the Saigon. I was a driver. So I got to drive everything. Well, in some respects, that's kind of a big deal, because, you know, you get to drive and go places, but you just want to sit in there. So that was, for lack of better words, that was fun.
Mm.
You know, because participating and doing things. Got to see a lot of the country. Took a lot of pictures along the way. And then we get to where we were supposed to be, and we'd get all set up and start our work all over again.
Something like Cedar Falls, obviously a very large operation. You arrive, where do you arrive, and how do you set up? What's the process for a group of people to start doing these interrogations?
Well, we would... You know, I'm not really sure the mechanism of how it was decided. We were taken to an area, so this is the area that you're going to occupy. And I think the Cedar Falls, we were in the Michelin rubber plantation. And so our tents were set up there. This is the one thing that really just stunned me. When we were packing up to go in, just make sure you bring, you know, at least two wool blankets. Wool blankets. I'm in Vietnam. I'm going out in the boonies. You want me to take wool blankets with me? Well, first night, I truly understood why. In the day in the Saigon area, you're doing 100 plus, and you get out into the rubber plantation, and it might be 50. So, yeah, you wanted the blanket. So, just set aside areas where we were conducting interrogation. These are prisoners that brought to us. They were young too. Started doing the things that we're used to doing, collecting information. I can't remember which operation it was, but I've got some clear pictures of it. We were all trucked into an area, and people were just coming out of the woodwork, coming out of the trees. They're all refugees. And I learned later on, they were pretty much cleared out of their own homes, huts, and they were forced into this area. The purpose of it, I gathered at that time, was to separate the DC from the villagers, or attempt to do that. And that's where things. We just had a free wheel to see if we could determine who was BC and who was in Norfolk and who was in fact a villager. Didn't worry too much about kids. Women were a little different in terms of whether they were hardcore to call on to it. Very interesting interrogation going on with one guy. And he just didn't look right, his color wasn't right. He was leaning over. There was something wrong with him. When she started examining him, she didn't have the markings of being a farmer. Calluses on his elbows and his knees and stuff like that. So when I got him undressed, he said, "I'm not understanding what was wrong with him." But he had a wound, but it was a through and through wound in his chest and his back, and it went right through his. Then, about the one I got the most roughly, I sat him down on an empty ammo box, mortar box, and had a big stick in there. I sat him on the box, made like I was going to start hitting the box. Of course, the box is empty, but he didn't. He was just nervous as all. It looked like he started crying at the drop of a hat. My interpreter kept telling me that she thought that he was not a South Sudanese, but a North Sudanese. We eventually got to the point that when he got wounded, he got taken to a NDA hospital that was underground. Treated him and took care of him and kept him alive. But obviously they didn't have the skill and or ability to reinflate his lungs. So that side of his chest was caved in, not out. And he was in pretty tough shape. But I did learn, what the unit was and when was he last in that hospital. Turns out that when he was picked up and brought into this, he was only a couple hours after leaving his unit. So in other words, he'd only been out in the air for a couple hours. So he and the remainder of his unit was a couple of hours away in terms of walking out of the house. It's not a big distance. So I spent some time with him in terms of trying to figure out on a map where his unit was located and things like that. I developed a pretty good piece of information, so then I went to all the battalions and got this information about where this battalion was located. And they're only a couple of hours away from me. Need some more information, so he then had me go down to S2 and report all that. Tickled to death, and apparently they spun up a helicopter group to go out to see if they could spot them. And sure as shit, they did. And what I never learned what the outcome of it was, but they did find them, they did engage them, and put the kibosh on the rest of their operations for that day. So I imagined in my mind that they may very well have done some tests, but also stopped at a group, a group that had been just raising holy cow in that area for a long time. So okay, I did my part.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Doug Hoyt. Today is 17 December 2019. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Hoyt is joining me by telephone from Montpelier, Vermont. Doug, one of the things that we haven't talked about yet in terms of your off time was extended off time, such as R&R. Did you get a chance to go on an R&R leave?
I did. I did two.
Two of them. Tell me about them.
First one, I'm not sure. First one was Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that was my first one. Went to Tokyo.
Why did you choose Tokyo?
I don't really know. I think it was because it was, bright lights, big city.
Mm.
I guess the rumors that there were bargains galore to be had if you were looking for high quality material, like watches or suits or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I did. That's why I went there. I can't recall any other compelling reason. So I went there. I didn't go with anybody in particular. My time all by myself. But I really wasn't by myself. In fact, I'm 95% positive that I ended up with a Navy corpsman. Met each other on the way to Tokyo, and we agreed to share a hotel room, and made that our base of operation. But we also went out and did things on our own, so it was good. It was a good way to get a good room and not spend a lot of money. And you have a very, very limited amount of time, so you got to make the most of it. And, I saw the sights, did the things, went to a couple of shows that, only because it was recommended you would do that. When I say shows, they were sort of like a theater show. Dancing and music and lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They also had, some of the dancing also included the traditional Japanese wear for women, kimonos and things like that, but it also included some burlesque type presentations, which were quite an event for So that was kind of exciting. She'll have to call me back. That was a lot of the time that was there. Delicately say if there was the opportunity to meet Japanese women and share time with them in terms of actually some nice meals, learn a little bit about Japanese culture, and when I say that with all sincerity and reality, it was a good thing to do. And I did do some shopping. I got my father a Seiko watch. Seiko at that time was, if I remember correctly, they were one of the world's best timepieces in terms of self-winding and those type of things. Again, bearing in mind that this is 67. And so I gave that to him when I came home. It just so happened that I still have that watch.
Hmm.
And it still works.
How about that?
Yeah. I don't wear it, but if I want to do it, go home and keep fantastic time and everything else. I have no idea if it's worth anything, but it's got more sentimental value than anything else. Those are the kind of things that I can't remember. I got a Bulova watch. A Bulova Accutron. Battery operated, so with tuning fork. I don't know if you know anything about that or not, but that was quite the thing. It was damn near like impossible to get here in the United States, but for a reasonable price, but you could get it there in Japan for reasonable money. Plus, I was a serviceman that had plenty of money because where the hell was I spending it? So I got one of those. And again, it just so happened that I still have that. And it still works just fine. And, in fact, I recently took it in for a battery and cleaning. The jeweler that I brought it to says, don't let anything happen to this. It was worth a fair amount. Okay, I won't. Nothing wrong with wanting to buy it. So, Tokyo was just bright lights, big city, and met a lot of people. Eventually had to go home. Or home, yeah. Get on a plane and go back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And, sure.
That was pretty good break. And,
What about the second R&R?
Second R&R, I went to Hong Kong. And, entirely different, yet in many ways similar. In Hong Kong, the Chinese were a little more aggressive in trying to separate you from your money. But it was about a year two later. The reason I did a second R&R is because I extended my tour. Extended my tour twice. When you extend your tour, you get a choice of an R&R or a home where you can do those kind of things. I can't remember now. I guess I'd have to look at some other stuff to refresh my memory. But it may come back to me while we're talking. But I think there was a... When I extended my tour the first time, we'll talk about the second time later. When I extended my tour the first time, I think I selected to go home. And I think I did that. That would have been give me a moment. 1960. That would have been in 67 when I did my first extension. So I went home. And, I hadn't been home for well over a year. So I went home and the family thing. And I had what amounted to close to 2 weeks at home. The Army military flew me from Vietnam to Vermont. So it was a good time at home. It was during the summer, so it was decent weather. I bought a car and then the rest of it knowing that I was going to come back. And all those crazy things that are, sort of 20 years old, lose some money. And I just had a good time. But again, like everything else, I had to go back.
Why did you choose to extend the first time?
The first time I chose to extend was they usually gave you a hint of where you were going to go when you came back. I was headed to I was headed to Fort Bragg. What they were going to have me do in Fort Bragg didn't appeal to me. I wanted to come back and I wanted to be able to do something that would give me the opportunity to improve my standing in the military. I didn't want to end up spending the last year or so painting rocks or doing mundane tasks because they really didn't have anything lined up for you to do. made the decision that I would stay in Vietnam and do what I was doing. Crazy or not, I enjoyed doing what I was doing. I enjoyed the ability to do the interrogations, the writing of the reports. Somewhere in my mind, I believe that I was making a difference. And, so that's why I stayed. And I was hoping that if they're gonna, when they sent me back, that they would do something that would give me more responsibility and the opportunity to achieve more rank and things like that. So. That's why I did that. And so I did stay. And all the things that I stayed for were true. And then, you know, along that time, when you're in that extended time, you're then working at your next extension. There was opportunity to go home, and it was only a 6 month time frame, I just had to worry about it. So that 6 month time frame was also tempered by the fact that if you extended, you got that additional R&R or trip or whatever you wanted to do. That 6 month was shortened up a little bit more by the time to leave and the time to get back and the time to do the funny thing. You've got a good portion of 1 month pretty well shot. So you really only have 5 months that you have to be concerned about. So then you started doing the calculating again. And I was getting close, to the end of that first 6 months. I had an opportunity to tell whomever that, here's what I want to do. Promotion, and I want the opportunity to go to either warrant officer school or officer candidate school. Wanted to make a difference. And the Army, true to its word at that time anyway, so apparently they listened, because the next assignment I'd come back to Fort Meade, the intelligence school was there at that time, and I guess I would have been given the opportunity to participate in instructions. I was definitely qualified and would have a fair chance of making E6 and would be considered for officer candidate school or other advancement. So I said, that's pretty good. And so I thought that over, but I had plenty of time to make a decision. But the decision, sort of got tempted by, this war isn't getting any better. And by at this time frame, it's 1968. Mid-1968, we've already gone through the Tet Offensive, things just aren't going well. People aren't happy at home, and maybe it's not time for me to stay in town. I delayed until the very last moment and then made the decision to go that. And when I got to the end of that second extension, I probably would not extend again. I'd go home. By doing so, with calculating, there was not enough time left for the end of my tour and the end of my enlistment
So you get out of the Army, separate from the Army when you get back home then immediately?
Yeah.
And when was that?
That would have been October of 68.
Okay. Well, what do you hope to do now that you're home? What do you hope to do with life and career?
Didn't have a clue. All I knew was I was home, I had a car, had a little bit of money, and nothing to fall back upon. So I ended up working for my father. He ran a cable TV operation. So it wasn't anything very technical. There was a lot of grunt work to climb poles, to go to places and install cable TV, hook up TV. People watch it. Everybody's happy. So I did that for a while, and then, this is getting old, and my future is not very strong here. So I went back to the concept of running shoe stores again. If you remember from the very beginning, I was managing a shoe store in Claremont, New Hampshire. Finally caught up with me. There was a lot of drafting, so I didn't join. And so I hooked up with another shoe company. And we were in the process of opening a shoe store here in the Montpelier area. So I did. I got hired as a manager and ran a store and did that for a while. Got married. That was a disaster. But that's for another day. So that's how I got back here. And when I got to Oakland, getting ready to fly back to the East Coast, the Army really laid it on. Re-up, carry out, and they'll give you a $10,000 bonus. You really pay attention to your wants and desires about education and advancement. So I had to really think that one over for a day before I said no. Oh, yes. Obviously, I said no. But, it's one of those things, the old saying, woulda, coulda, shoulda. I can get into that woulda, coulda, shoulda mode, but, I slap myself down and say, you can't do that. You did what you did. You did it for good reasons at the time. There are no mistakes.
Sure. Well, I've got just a couple questions for you, Doug, before we wrap it up. Looking back on your time in Vietnam, it was extensive, of course. You extended on two separate occasions. How would you say your time in Vietnam, your experiences there, most affected the rest of your life?
I think I did a lot of growing up at the time, in the sense that coming from, even though Montpelier is the capital, it's small.
Mm-hmm.
It was small in 1966, and it's still small. But it had a lot of, back up here. My players changed quite a bit since the 60s. It was pretty much a conservative conservative Republican based area with a lot of, you know, old world Republican conservative ideas. That's not the case anymore. It's Montpelier itself is a fairly liberal progressive community. A lot of young people are coming to the city of Frostburg in that way. But a lot of the people in the area around it were also liberal, so there was always this period of conflict, not in a nasty sense, but always a period of conflict. But I think having been to Vietnam, coming back, and all the other things, had a better idea on the different viewpoints that various people had, and tried like crazy to accept their viewpoints and listen to them. The effect on me as an individual is that I grew to be more willing to listen to people, but at the same time, I became perhaps maybe less tolerant of people who held ideas that were not that were not kind. In other words, I didn't particularly care for people that were made fun of a person or ridicule the person because of their hair, their color, or whatever. We're all here together. You can't get along, but at least we ought to try. But I think that's what Vietnam is. I did not become an anti-war person, but I did come to the conclusion that some of the stuff that we were told about Vietnam just wasn't true. At the same time, the Vietnamese people were not bad people. In fact, they were very good. Poor guy that came down from North Vietnam intending to kill me and anything else. And the reason he did that is because he didn't really know any better. And but the same thing could be said about us being there. Some of us didn't know any better. So, but I did run into a lot of fellow servicemen who really did not. I don't know why. But, it's just one of those things that you didn't like.
Yeah. Well, last question I have for you, Doug. Kind of a broad question, but having been there as long as you were there perhaps gives you certainly gives you a unique perspective on the war itself. What do we take away from this war? What's the legacy? What do we take away?
Ooh, that's tough. Especially based on what I said. I think as a country, as a society, we took away from whole message that would be critical for us as a society, that when these things come up that we really, really question not only ourselves, but also our so-called leaders. And before we start committing ourselves to those type of actions, we want to make sure that we're telling us the truth. Unfortunately, history will bear this out. We didn't really learn that lesson very well, because we went back into another country shortly after 2001 and proceeded to get thousands and thousands of Americans killed and maimed. Dresser, you're going to find a lot of items that you're wearing that are made in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you'd have told me 40 years ago that would be one of the things that would be happening, I'd think you were absolutely nuts and have managed to get yourself into some really bad bruise or something. You just didn't figure that would be the case. I'd love to go back. Well, I don't know. I guess I got off the track there.
No. That's perfectly fine. Well, Doug, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we bring it to a close?
I guess it's one of those things that I'll never know. Which is one of the reasons why I was drawn to the Vietnam Veterans Archives that you're responsible for. And I know that I found a couple of some of my reports, but I'd like to find more.
Yeah.
I suspect you got them. So I'll keep looking. I got a Bronze Star. I got the Joint Chiefs of Staff Commendation Medal, which I'm positively proud of both of them.
Sure.
visit them. So, like it or not, we're probably going to hear about this for a while.
Sure. I'm certainly easy to find. Okay, start from the beginning there, Doug. You were talking about picking up a high value enemy prisoner.
Right. It was an NVA, colonel. You need somebody that would go up and away and pick him up and bring him back to see them. I think I got picked. Why, I don't know. But it's one of those things, you know, the tempting thought here is to just kind of sit there and say, no. And yeah, okay. Get your orders and you take off and you go. And I think it took me just one day to make it up the way, but you know, I didn't stay over overnight. You know, I was picked up at the airfield, taken to their compound, and you know, it's just a small compound in the city of Way, you know, where the MI guys were located. And the prison was there, so I was going to be spending the night, and had a nice dinner. I think they had a movie. At one time, I'm walking on the compound, you know, I'm looking at the, you know, the entrance to the, you know, to the office. And they had wooden cutouts of mortar shells. They had dates on them. I kind of guessed what they were, but I asked, what are all those, you know, mortar shells with dates on them? Those are the dates that we've been mortared. I said, wow. So you mean you actually receive incoming mortar rounds in the compound? I said, oh yeah. Sometimes they hit, sometimes they don't. I said, well, that's good to know. And so I'm looking at them, and I'm going, why don't you tell me what you do in the event that you're under a mortar attack? I said, well, they explained it all. Take cover, leave your racks, and you've got these shipping containers that are surrounded by, you know, sandbags, and that's where you take cover. Okay. So he said, why do you ask? He says, well, maybe it's just me, but if you look at those dates, they're all pretty much within the last week of any given month. And it's the end of the month, so I'm guessing that you're pretty close to getting another mortar attack. The bad which I mean is, I never thought about that. I guess I'm doing a little calculation in myself. I said, I'm the interrogator, the analyst. Those things are supposed to make a difference to me. So at any rate, do all that stuff, like get into the sack and everything else, and surely God knows little green apples incoming. Bang. Motor rounds are going off all over the place. I've got knocked off the top rack. My rack went to the floor. I grabbed the mattress, pulled it over on top of me, and prayed, and then pretty soon that was all over. So I did. Helmet, vest, and a rifle. I think I did put on my boots. That was it. Didn't have anything else on, other than pair of shorts. And we got out there, dove in there. Shit. There's probably 6 inches of water in there. And the whole battalion of mosquitoes. And we're just in there waiting for more to come in. And they did. They come in and they're kind of got close to coming through the barrier, but they were repelled. Bottom line is, I didn't get any more hurt. I'm just sorry, we're all done. I'll go back, put the barracks things back together, and actually go to sleep. It's a crazy world. So at any rate, did that. Got up the next morning, did the breakfast routine, and then got my prisoner and got to the airfield. My transportation was Air America. Silver-colored twin prop, sort of like Sky King there. Probably carried 10-15 people. So I get in, the pilot says, why don't you come up here and sit next to me? Motion to the co-pilot seat. And I said, yep, I've got prison. He says, that's okay. Once we're in here, he's not going anywhere. Yeah, I guess that's probably a true story. But all these people, they were all, most of them were out meeting me. There was only a couple of military guys. Of course, I didn't want to. I knew at the time that Air America and the CIA. So why I ended up on a CIA plane and a prisoner. We took off, and I think they made it to Da Nang this time. And I had to go find a flight. And went back to Thompson Creek. I had a little bit of difficulty with that, but I used my orders. And the fact that I was carrying a weapon, but didn't have any rank on it, but the U.S. caller passed. Eventually, that's somebody that maybe I think I ended up on. There's another twin engine prop, but a bigger one. I made it back to Thompson and finally got some of the new prisoner out. He and I got along fine. He didn't make any efforts to take off on me. Scared to death. Didn't know where he was, where he was going. But it worked out good. And that's pretty much the same for memory comes back. I remember I took a helicopter trip and we took some prisoners and refugees with us on a Huey. Comical in many respects, but the cities didn't need to stuff into a helicopter. But Americans taking them someplace. I can't remember why they were taking them. Sounds like they were just leaving them for another holding area for interrogations. And they were absolutely scared to death. They're up a couple thousand feet, looking down, and I know that every single one of them is gone. This is when the Americans pull you out of the helmet. I stop and think about it afterwards. The highest off the ground, these people have been probably up a tree. Wind and everything else, it's got to be absolutely terrorist.
Sure.
It just has to be. I'll give you two more helicopter stories. One of them was, I saw a couple of guys, and I can't remember who, Christmas. So it was around this time of the year. And, oh, I know. We were out in the field and we were operating in support of the 1st Infantry Division. And I think this is Cedar Falls. Some of us went down to where the helicopters are coming along. We wanted to see if we could hook a ride from there to, I can't remember where, but it was wherever the USO show was being held that had Bob Hope, but the L.L. and some others. And so we managed to convince them that we ought to be in the cold. And so this isn't a dead of night, mid evening. And we're on the Huey, and we're headed. We have no orders, we have no authorization. Positives that are whatever heights we're going along and looking out, and it's a whole new experience for me anyway. You see all these explosions that are happening on the ground around you, and we try to get clear in our mind, how do you know where you're going and how do you avoid artillery shells that are flying through the air? Not sure we've got a real good answer. But the other thing that was really kind of door guy on my side where I was sitting was drunker than drunk. He managed to throw up whatever he had as we were flying along. And I'm like, all right, there's some DC down there and it gets hit with this stuff. He's going to take the measures and put themselves on an entirely new weapon. It's not going. But anyway, we got there, we found some other guys, we got ourselves in a bunk, woke up the next day, went to mess hall, got breakfast, and got some pretty good seats for the USO show, and then we did the reverse. After the show was over, we went and found a helicopter and went back. Don't think anybody even knew we were gone.
Is that right?
It was different. And, the only other one I'll tell you about was interesting. We were flying from one place to another. Then it was another operation. And, got on a Huey, and it turns out that the pilot, his last flight, done with this flight, he was all done, and pack up his clothes and head home. And they were all celebrating this flight. And they'd taken off. One of his fellow celebrants was standing on the skids while we were flying. So he's doing some hot shot flying, and we're at treetops and lower. And we're flying along and he's pulling weeds in and around the trees and stuff and going by villages and really low. It's a nice place to be in. Prime target. Somebody take a shot at it. I mean, I can look out to the side and I can see people that are just doing their farming, taking care of their animals, and they're sitting on the ground and we're almost eye to eye. There's some distance between us, but eye to eye, I'm just going to make sure I made myself as small as I can be. We made it, and did a lot of those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that back up. Related to that story tonight.
I'll tell you what. It is snowing like crazy right now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.